A century ago, the governments of the most powerful countries on the planet launched what later became known as World War I, the first all-out conflagration of the modern era, pitting one set of great powers, a bloc centering on Germany and Austria-Hungary, against another, a bloc centering on Britain, France, and Russia, and later including the United States. Lasting 4.5 bloody years, the war left more than 10 million dead and the economic infrastructure of continental Europe in ruins. By the end of the conflict, the world's geopolitical map had been redrawn as old empires, the Russian, Ottoman, and Austro-Hungarian, were destroyed. A wave of revolution swept Europe, culminating in the audacious seizure of power by the working class in Russia in October 1917. Marxists at the time sought to make sense of the social forces that had pushed humanity into the cataclysm of World War I. They concluded that global capitalism had entered into a new phase of development over the preceding few decades, a phase they called imperialism, which had exacerbated the contradictions of capitalist society, leading inexorably to armed conflict. Viewing the war as the result of inter-imperialist rivalries, revolutionary socialists such as V.I. Lenin, whose seminal pamphlet Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, from 1916, elaborated the theoretical framework of the concept. They argued that capitalism had demonstrated in the trenches and on the battlefields that it had outlived its historical utility and was no longer a force for progress. Now, much has changed over the past 100 years. Many of the features that marked the global system a century ago have undergone significant modifications. Colonial empires, for instance, are largely a thing of the past. While the once overwhelmingly agrarian and pre-capitalist hinterlands of the European and North American-based empires have experienced considerable industrialization, social revolutions, moreover, often led by peasant-based movements modeled after the Soviet Union following its degeneration under Stalin in the 1920s, transformed the production relations in which large numbers of the world's population were involved, most notably China in 1949. Yet, despite these changes, the world economy is fundamentally shaped by the key forces analyzed a century ago by Marxists such as Lenin. A system in an advanced state of decay, global capitalism generates ever-worsening economic crises, social polarization and the impoverishment of billions of human beings, ecological destruction, and the very same geopolitical tensions that twice plunged the world into inter-imperialist war. Imperialist powers continue to meddle in the affairs of their hinterlands as they violently attempt to secure influence and open up areas for foreign investment and exploitation. On the centennial of World War I, it is instructive to reflect on the origins and essential features of the epoch of war and revolution, as Lenin called the imperialist era, and recall the social forces that led to the so-called Great War, forces that not only opened up one of the darkest chapters in human history, but also set the stage for one of the brightest shimmers of hope, the revolutionary overturn of capitalism in Russia in 1917. Okay. Empires existed long before capitalism, as Leon Trotsky observed at the beginning of World War II. He wrote, "History has known the imperialism of the Roman state based on slave labor, the imperialism of feudal land ownership, the imperialism of commercial and industrial capital, the imperialism of the czarist monarchy, etc. However, in contemporary literature, at least Marxist literature, imperialism is understood to mean the expansionist policy of finance capital, which has a very sharply defined economic content. 22 years earlier, Lenin had defined imperialism as the domination of finance capital. Now, he borrowed that term, finance capital, from the Austrian Marxist economist Rudolf Hilferding, who wrote an influential book of the same name in 1910. Essentially, finance capital refers to the giant corporations of the advanced capitalist centers, huge monopolies and oligopolies, combining banking, financial, and industrial activity. Lenin identified the economic tendency toward monopoly as a key feature of imperialism, which involves the export of capital by these corporations. He wrote, "If it were necessary to give the briefest possible definition of imperialism, we should have to say that imperialism is the monopoly stage of capitalism. Such a definition would include what is most important, for on the one hand, finance capital is the bank capital of a very few big monopolist banks merged with the capital of the monopolist associations of industrialists. And on the other hand, the division of the world is the transition from a colonial policy, which has extended without hindrance to territories unseized by any capitalist power, to a colonial policy of monopolist possession of the territory of the world, which has been completely divided up." In his book, The Age of Empire, 1875 to 1914, the late British historian Eric Hobsbawm discussed how the initial technological advantages enjoyed by West European powers over their colonial subjects increased exponentially in the course of the Industrial Revolution of the late 18th and 19th centuries. Once they established themselves as developed metropolitan centers, the European states continued to widen the gap between themselves and the colonies and semi-colonies of the periphery they dominated. Indeed, imperialism, as a system of surplus value extraction on a global scale, is characterized by a tendency to deepen and extend social inequality, both at home and abroad. A 2001 study by the OECD showed how world economic or world income inequality has increased over centuries of capitalist development. The study reports, by 1820, the developed capitalist countries of Western Europe, North America, Australasia, and Japan had forged ahead to an income level twice that in the rest of the world. By 1998, the gap was 7-1. Between the United States, the present world leader, and Africa, the poorest region, the gap is now 20-1. This gap is still widening. 2 years earlier, the UNDP had made a parallel observation. It noted, "World inequalities have been rising steadily for nearly two centuries. An analysis of long-term trends in world income distribution between countries shows that the distance between the richest and the poorest country was about 3-1 in 1820, 11-1 in 1913, 35-1 in 1950, 44-1 in 1973, and 72-1 in 1992. The persistence and growth of the disparity between those at the top and those at the bottom of the global economic order is hardly surprising, given that development in the colonies and semi-colonies, particularly with the advent of modern imperialism in the last third of the 19th century, has largely been shaped by the requirements of imperialist investors who export capital abroad in search of higher profit rates. Colonial holdings were valued as sources of raw materials, markets for industrial products, and opportunities for profitable investment, which took various forms. Each of these elements both spurred the capitalist transformation of the colonies and warped their development. The importation of cheap commodities from the metropolitan center, for instance, expanded market relations while undermining native producers. Displaced handicraft workers and peasants who had been pushed off their traditional lands to make way for plantations formed a landless rural proletariat. At the same time, indigenous capitalists, largely excluded from industrial production, tended to concentrate in commerce and moneylending, which helped maintain a parasitical landlord caste that reinforced backward traditions. Trotsky described the pattern of capitalist development across the globe as combined and uneven. A backward country, these are his words, assimilates the material and intellectual conquests of the advanced countries. But this does not mean that it follows them slavishly, reproduces all the stages of their past. Capitalism prepares and, in a certain sense, realizes the universality and permanence of man's development. By this, a repetition of the forms of development, by different nations, is ruled out. Although compelled to follow after the advanced countries, a backward country does not take things in the same order. The privilege of historic backwardness compels the adoption of whatever is ready in advance of any specified date, skipping a whole series of intermediate stages. The development of historically backward nations leads necessarily to a peculiar combination of different stages in the historic process. Their development as a whole acquires a planless, complex, combined character. Unevenness, the most general law of the historic process, reveals itself most sharply and complexly in the destiny of the backward countries. Under the whip of external necessity, their backward culture is compelled to make leaps. From the universal law of unevenness thus derives another law, which, for lack of a better name, we may call the law of combined development, by which we mean a drawing together of the different stages of the journey, a combining of the separate steps, an amalgam of archaic with more contemporary forms. Imperialism increases the unevenness of development, generating various combinations of social production relations, mangling, misshaping, and holding back economic growth, particularly in the non-imperialist countries. The rising tide of global capitalism does not lift all boats, but rather lifts a handful of yachts while wrecking and sinking most ships. At the level of ideology, the grotesque disparities of development and underdevelopment were often rationalized by the European empire builders of the 19th and 20th centuries by notions of a white man's burden to bring Christian enlightenment and modernity to savages. While such overt racism would become an embarrassment to most apologists of imperialism within a few generations, we still today encounter the view of the supposed superiority of Europeans or Japanese and or their cultures. Such ideas provide a rationale for maintaining and in some ways reflect a world order that condemns the bulk of humanity to misery. Finance capital's establishment of global social relations of exploitation involved at the same time a transformation of the system of international relations, especially as the division of the globe into spheres of influence evolved into the redivision of the world by the dominant powers. The growth of monopoly capitalism reduced competition within each country, but the expansionist policy of finance capital emerging from that process led to the competitive pursuit of exclusive access to investment opportunities, new markets, and raw materials abroad for the imperialist centers. Lenin wrote that the latest stage of capitalism shows us that certain relations between capitalist associations grow up based on the economic division of the world. while parallel to and in connection with it, certain relations grow up between political alliances, between states, on the basis of the territorial division of the world, of the struggle for colonies, of the struggle for spheres of influence. By the early years of the 20th century, the pursuit of spheres of influence had turned into an arms race, culminating in the outbreak of World War I. Writing in 1916, Lenin observed that rather than a war to end war, World War I was the product of the competing claims of the imperialist powers. Winston Churchill expressed a similar thought 8 months before the commencement of hostilities, when in January 1914, he commented to his cabinet colleagues, quote, "We have engrossed to ourselves an altogether disproportionate share of the wealth and traffic of the world. We have got all we want in territory, and our claim to be left in the unmolested enjoyment of vast and splendid possessions, mainly acquired by violence, largely maintained by force, often seems less reasonable to others than to us." When the war finally did break out, it had a profound effect not only on the international state system and the share of the wealth going to the different imperialist powers, but on the daily lives of hundreds of millions of people as well. It also forever transformed politics and the labor movement. Prior to the war, the leaders of the Socialist International and its affiliated mass trade unions had pledged to organize international labor resistance to any conflict. In August 1914, however, most of them quickly swung over to support their own imperialist rulers' claims in the scramble to redivide the world. Rallying to the slogan, "Defense of the Fatherland," the leaders of virtually every section of the international urged workers to kill and be killed on behalf of their own nationalists, their national ruling class. Now, some remained true to the internationalist program of Marxism during the darkest hours of the war, when the population was caught up in patriotic fervor as the world descended into bloodshed. Among the leaders who rejected the social patriotic capitulation of the Second International were Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht of Germany, and Lenin and Trotsky of Russia. Key to salvaging the traditions of socialism from the wreckage of the war was the contribution of Lenin. Not only did Lenin help develop the Marxist understanding of imperialism, he made the singular most important theoretical and practical organizational advance, the Vanguard Party. Lenin, along with his comrade Grigory Zinoviev from the Bolshevik Party in Russia, argued that the imperialist plunder had laid the material foundation for a section of the working class, its upper echelons, to be corrupted or bought off by the capitalists. Generalizing Frederick Engels' notion of the labor aristocracy created by the British Empire, Lenin argued that the aristocratic layer of the working class, represented by a privileged labor bureaucracy running the trade unions and socialist political parties, had a contradictory but real interest in maintaining capitalism. Reformism and pro-imperialism, therefore, found expression within the workers' movement and would continue to do so until capitalism had been destroyed. Prior to 1914, Lenin had, at least on a formal theoretical level, operated within the framework of Karl Kautsky's party of the whole class concept, whereby all self-professed socialists should fight alongside one another in a broad-based party encompassing all or most political tendencies within the workers' movement. In a pamphlet called The Collapse of the Second International, written in 1915, Lenin wrote, "This crisis, or rather the crisis created by the Great War has torn away all coverings, swept away all conventions, exposed an abscess that has long come to a head, and revealed opportunism in its true role of ally of the bourgeoisie. The complete organizational severance of this element from the workers' parties has become imperative. The epoch of imperialism cannot permit the existence in a single party of the revolutionary proletariat's vanguard and the semi-petty bourgeois aristocracy of the working class, who enjoy morsels of the privileges of their own nation's great power status. The old theory that opportunism is a legitimate shade in a single party that knows no extremes has now turned into a tremendous deception of the workers and a tremendous hindrance to the working class movement. Lenin proposed a party of a new type, an organization built around a thoroughly Marxist program. Initially comprising only the most committed socialist militants, the Vanguard Party would seek to win mass support and a mass membership through its demonstrated adherence to the cause of working class revolution. Lenin's organizational conception, combined with the Marxist understanding of imperialism that he helped develop, provided the basis for reorganizing the forces of international socialism on a new revolutionary foundation. It would, however, take a major advance in the real history of the class struggle to achieve this reorganization, the victorious proletarian socialist revolution in Russia in October 1917. Russia was the most economically backward of the imperialist powers. That is certainly not where Marxists had imagined or hoped the workers would first seize power. Yet the socialist breakthrough in Russia was above all a product of the maturation and decay of capitalism on a global scale, and its transformation into imperialism, a world system in which Russia played a leading, if comparatively weak, role. Trotsky described Russia under the Romanov dynasty as follows. In one sense, Tsarist Russia was also a colonial country, and this found its expression in the predominant role of foreign capital. But the Russian bourgeoisie enjoyed the benefits of an immeasurably greater independence from foreign imperialism than the Chinese bourgeoisie. Russia itself was an imperialist country. Reflecting the combined and uneven development of capitalism, Russia was forced to become a participant in the new system of imperialism owing to its status as a world power. In his pamphlet Socialism and War in 1915, Lenin observed that while older-style military and feudal imperialism predominated, in Russia, capitalist imperialism of the latest type, that is, finance capital imperialism, has fully revealed itself in the policy of Tsarism towards Persia, Manchuria, and Mongolia. In the latter period of the Romanov dynasty, Russian capitalists were exporting significant amounts of capital abroad, even as France and other advanced capitalist countries were investing heavily in the creation of Russian factories, railroads, and other components of a modern industrial economy. According to Alexander S. Bulatov, a professor at Moscow's Russian Foreign Trade Academy, and this is from a study from 1998 in a journal called Transnational Corporations, Russian firms started to invest abroad in the last decades of the 19th century. Capital was exported primarily to China and Persia, as well as to Mongolia. During the period 1886 to 1914, Russian capital exports amounted to the equivalent of $33 billion at 1996 prices. Yet Russia's rapid, if narrowly based, industrial development in the pre-war period sank its rulers into debt to its European allies. Russian capitalists entered World War I with the intention of seizing new territories and intensifying the exploitation of Persia, Manchuria, etc. But the antiquated social order could not withstand the strains of a protracted conflict. Mounting debts, the absence of land reform, the hunger of workers, all of these factors were acutely felt and exacerbated as the war exacted heavy price in blood from Russia, whose mostly peasant armies were ground up in the German war machine. In February 1917, the population of Russia had had enough, and a bread riot in St. Petersburg, led by proletarian women, unleashed a torrent of pent-up revolutionary energy, toppling the Tsar. A situation of dual power emerged, with a bourgeois provisional government, including an increasing number of nominally socialist elements resting on the old state institutions, sitting uneasily alongside the councils, or Soviets in the Russian language, that had sprung up from the working class and other oppressed layers. Russia's bourgeoisie had pumped billions into the neighboring backward countries before the war, and the prospect of defeat was viewed as terminal for its imperial ambitions. Now, naturally, the liberal capitalist political elements were committed to pursuing the war, but so too were the socialists who sat in the bourgeois government and who were numerically dominant in the Soviets well into the summer. Yet as the war dragged on, the situation continued to worsen, and the contradictions of dual power were coming to a head. The revolutionary wing of the workers' movement, centered on the Bolshevik Party, headed by Lenin, joined shortly by Trotsky, grew in influence. In alliance with a split away from the peasant-based social revolutionaries and coordinating with anarchists, the Bolsheviks transformed their majority in the Soviets into a bold seizure of power in October 1917, inaugurating the world's first successful proletarian socialist revolution. Imperialism was beginning to come apart, as the social contradictions generated by the system had broken the chain at its weakest link. This expression, Russia being the weakest link in the imperialist chain, Trotsky wrote, this is Lenin's splendid formula. Its meaning is that Russia was the most backward and economically weakest of the imperialist states. That is precisely why her ruling classes were the first to collapse, as they had loaded an unbearable burden on the insufficient productive forces of the country. Uneven, sporadic development thus compelled the proletariat of the most backward imperialist country to be the first to seize power. The October Revolution shone a beacon of hope around the world, as it appeared that the Russian working class, of all people, had found a way out of the nightmare of imperialism through socialist revolution. Militant strike waves swept the advanced capitalist world at the close of the war, which ended in November 1918. In Germany, the Kaiser was overthrown, and a revolutionary period opened up during which the working class could have taken power, prevented only by the absence of a mature vanguard party. Italy, too, entered a revolutionary situation, and a short-lived Soviet republic was declared in Hungary. In 1919, the revolutionary wing of the socialist movement, centered on the Bolshevik Party, met in Moscow to found a new third or communist international. Yet the tide of revolution, unleashed by the imperialist war, receded due to an uptick in economic activity and to repression from the state, capital, and fascists, conditioned by the incompetency and outright treachery of working class leadership. Isolated and suffering from tremendous material hardships, the Soviet worker state underwent a process of bureaucratic degeneration, as the revolutionary left opposition, led by Trotsky, lost out to the forces of political counter-revolution that had coalesced around Joseph Stalin. given the weight of the Russian party within the Communist International, it too eventually succumbed to bureaucratic degeneration, transforming itself from a weapon of global socialist revolution into a mechanism to derail revolution, as seen most tragically in China in 1927 and Spain in 1936. Stalin's reactionary policy of building socialism in one country, in the Soviet Union, translated into the Kremlin's pursuit of alliances with democratic imperialist powers. The sabotage of revolutionary situations in China, Spain, France, and other countries saved capitalism from destruction, extending the life of imperialism, which once again, in 1939, plunged the world into global war. Tens of millions were killed, and the economies of Europe were laid to waste for a second time. Paradoxically, this destruction and the sabotage of revolutionary potential in the immediate post-war period by the Stalinists, Social Democrats, and their affiliated trade union bureaucracies laid the foundation for expanded capitalist accumulation and renewed growth under the hegemony of the U.S., which had emerged from the war largely unscathed. Consolidating its dominant position in the post-World War II period, the U.S. presided over the liquidation of the European colonial empires, seeking to unite the free world against the Soviet challenge and the Chinese Revolution. In pursuit of this objective, American planners actively discouraged the protectionist impulses of Washington's allies while making some concessions to integrate them into a new global capitalist order headed by the U.S. Although tensions among the imperialist rivals persisted, they were muted to a significant extent owing to the overwhelming dominance of American imperialism within world capitalism and to the geopolitical requirements of the Cold War. Although direct colonial rule largely disappeared as states across Africa and Asia gained independence in the decades following World War II, a more flexible and supple neo-colonial system emerged. Over the long term, neo-colonies suffered the same fate as formal colonies, that is, a net outflow of value to more developed imperialist countries. Fundamentally, imperialist exploitation of the non-imperialist countries, often facilitated by institutions such as the World Bank and the IMF, continues to rest on the export of capital, both in the form of overproduced commodities and foreign investment, by the big monopolies, so-called multinational corporations. Decolonization modified the form, but not the essence, of this process. Moreover, military aggression by the imperialists has continued to be a feature of the post-colonial era. While the U.S. favored breaking up the colonial empires of its European rivals, which often sought to maintain their holdings with violence, Washington was quick to reassert its own right to impose its will through brute force in the so-called Third World. Nonetheless, the existence of the Soviet Union limited both the scope of imperialist domination in the Third World and bolstered resistance to it. This was most obvious in the dramatic conflicts with insurrectionary Stalin's movements in Korea and Indochina, and subsequently with Castro's Cuba. But the presence of the Soviet Union also made it easier for the national bourgeoisie of countries like India and Brazil to assert some degree of economic independence. Soviet support for Egypt's Gamal Abdel Nasser's successful seizure of the Suez Canal in 1956 opened the door for most Middle Eastern states to nationalize their oil industries. In many countries, the national bourgeoisie experimented with import substitution industrialization, and some attempted to form producer cartels modeled on OPEC. the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. When interest rates rose steeply in the 1980s, many neo-colonies were forced to turn to the IMF to avoid defaulting on sovereign debts run up during the 1960s and 1970s. The price exacted by the IMF was the imposition of structural adjustment programs that reduced tariff protections, deregulated industry, privatized utilities, and other state enterprises, and slashed subsidies for farmers and domestic manufacturers. These austerity packages, which were defended as part of the so-called Washington Consensus, were marketed as a way to accelerate growth by lowering government overheads and shifting the economy toward exports. Yet the net effect was to drive down living standards, increase market penetration by imperialist corporations, and deepen the dependence of the developing countries on global capital markets. Industrialization continued, indeed rapidly expanded, but instead of domestically owned import substitution, neo-colonial economies were further subordinated to those of the advanced capitalist countries, as imperialist corporations shifted substantial elements of the production chain to low-wage areas of the globe in an effort to offset falling profit rates in the metropolitan centers. In 1980, manufactured goods comprised roughly 20% of developing countries' exports. By 2000, the figure was 70%. In 1980, half the world's industrial workers were still found in what were then known as the industrialized countries, like Canada. And today, these countries are home to merely a fifth. The industrialization of the global south, within the structures of imperialism, has taken place on terms designed to enhance the profits of the imperialist corporations, not lift the mass of the world's population out of poverty. Decades of export-oriented modernization directed by the imperialists have produced a world in which 2.5 billion people, a third of humanity, attempt to survive on less than $2 a day. More than 1 billion human beings are chronically malnourished, and a similar number lack access to clean drinking water, while the pursuit of short-term profit increasingly threatens the planet's entire ecosystem. In 1991, the Soviet degenerated worker state was destroyed by capitalist counter-revolution, which further accelerated the processes of neoliberal globalization and put wind in the sails of the imperialists. It also set the stage for the reassertion of conflicting imperialist interests of the sort that violently erupted in World War I and World War II. Indeed, while the colonial empires of the Victorian era are no more, the division of the world into spheres of influence, albeit overlapping and interpenetrating to a larger degree than 100 years ago, that combined with competition for access to markets and raw materials is a central and increasingly prominent feature of global politics. Also of continuing importance is the use of brute military force by the imperialists to impose their will in the neo-colonies when market mechanisms prove insufficient. In recent years, as the political spectrum has shifted rightward, with large-scale military interventions in the neo-colonies, many of capitalism's defenders have begun to openly acknowledge and embrace the reality of imperialism. As the U.S. prepared for the 2003 invasion of Iraq, the Washington Post's neoconservative columnist Charles Krauthammer observed, quote, "People are now coming out of the closet on the word empire." Over the past two decades, the U.S. and its imperialist allies have bombed and or invaded the former Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Libya, Yemen, Somalia, now Syria, and have threatened others with military action, including North Korea and Iran. French imperialism has attempted to reassert itself militarily in its former colonial empire in Africa, while Canada and other second-tier imperialists seek opportunities to extend their own grip on the neo-colonies through military intervention in Iraq, for instance. Western imperialists have actively supported the fascist-backed coup in Ukraine earlier this year, and now, to counter the influence of Russia, threaten a military buildup in Eastern Europe that, in the worst-case scenario, could lead to a disastrous global conflict the likes of which we have not seen in generations. The latest episode of imperial belligerence in the neo-colonies centers on the emergence of the Islamic State, or ISIS, as the power in large swaths of Iraq and Syria. Washington funneled weapons to militants fighting in the Syrian civil war against the regime of Bashar al-Assad, which is supported by Iran and Russia. Many of those weapons ended up in the hands of Sunni jihadists who later founded ISIS along with former al-Qaeda members in Iraq. 35 years ago, the U.S. armed the forerunners of the Taliban and al-Qaeda, including Osama bin Laden himself, in Afghanistan to counter the Soviets. ISIS would appear to be another Frankenstein's monster, whose rapid territorial conquests, conditioned by the sectarian hostilities unleashed by the 2003 imperialist invasion and subsequent maneuvering, have taken the Obama administration by surprise. Now, Washington finds itself in a de facto military bloc with Tehran and Damascus as it bombs ISIS targets, although of course these governments do not support U.S. bombing in Syria. Socialists have a responsibility to oppose any and all military adventures by the imperialists in the neocolonial world. While we have no political sympathy for ISIS or for Assad or Iran's mullahs for that matter, we favor the defeat of any imperialist intervention and the military victory of any indigenous forces who find themselves attacked by the imperialists and their proxies. In the case of inter-imperialist conflicts, such as World War I and World War II, however, revolutionaries are for the defeat of the imperialists on both sides. We begin from the perspective articulated by Karl Liebknecht that the main enemy is at home. Imperialism is an endless nightmare. It is an epoch of war, as Lenin explained a century ago. None of the major developments within the system over the past 100 years has changed that. So long as capitalism is permitted to exist, we are faced with the future of neocolonial military adventures and the prospect of a third world war. Yet imperialism also remains an epoch of revolution. The contradictions of global capitalism, a system that has long outlived its historical welcome and which now stagnates, cannot but generate intense social conflict, which will ultimately produce revolutionary situations. In October 1917, the Russian working class resolved such a situation in favor of the seizure of power, smashing imperialism at its weakest link. Whether or not future revolutionary opportunities will end in victory or defeat depends on whether or not socialists are able to build revolutionary parties. Now, obviously, the challenge is immense. The creation of a mass organization modeled on the Third International of Lenin and Fourth International Trotsky seems a distant prospect. But the laws of history have not been suspended. The working class continues to have a material interest that is fundamentally opposed to the maintenance of the capitalist system. With time, opportunity, and the intervention of serious militants, workers can finish the job of moving humanity beyond the highest stage of capitalism toward a global, classless society. I'll end it.